Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Before the break, researcher Michael Holtzman talked about the factors he sees as contributing to the high rate of black male incarceration in Milwaukee. High among them was the Milwaukee Police Department's role in enforcement and how arrests for sometimes nonviolent crime feed into the cycle of incarceration. Not surprisingly, the police department itself has a different take on how it fits into the equation. Edward Flynn is Milwaukee's chief of police, and he joins us in the studio to discuss that issue and also some of the top storylines for the police department in 2013. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So I want to start with a few questions linked to our Project Milwaukee series. Several people we've spoken with have pointed to the role of law enforcement, and so I wanted to get your take on a couple of the most consistent critiques that we've heard. Mm-hmm. And one is this idea that there are traffic infractions that are happening for which black drivers are stopped, things like burned out lights over license plates, seatbelt violations, tinted windows in certain neighborhoods, while white drivers in what people might think of as safer neighborhoods are not pulled over. And let me just ask you, is that happening?
We do traffic enforcement all over the city, but I think I need to clarify something and provide some perspective. We try to make our practices evidence-based, and there has been substantial research in the past that's indicated that when the General Patrol Force engages in traffic enforcement activity, it can have a direct impact on the amount of street crime in the areas in which these stops take place. So we embarked on a very assertive program of doing car stops in high crime areas, but we specifically stipulated in the policy that started this initiative that the goal was not to raise revenue and burden poor people with tickets because we were trying to protect them. We wanted to use traffic infractions as a lawful reason to stop cars in high crime areas. Why? Because these are where the most stolen cars are, because the robberies occur here, because people who steal cars often commit robberies with them. Groups of young men in stolen Chrysler minivans are one of the most frequent perpetrators of robberies in the city. So the goal is to have an impact on that behavior through the use of traffic enforcement. You know, as I said, we told our officers, if you can possibly give a warning out, do it. So, you know, we ramped up our traffic stops probably from something like 50-some thousand a year to 180,000 a year. And every year, the number of citations we gave out decreased. All right?
So that number you have is for stops, but right. Some of those people who are stopped don't get citations.
80% of the people we stop don't get a citation. We are obviously in positions where if somebody does something truly reckless and we stop them, or if they don't have a license, and I know that's been an issue addressed by this series, but I mean we're kind of left holding the bag. If we stop, you don't have a license, we can't say, you know, go and drive. But we are not writing lots of tickets for, you know, broken taillights, even though we're stopping people for it. People who make the right turn on the stop sign but didn't put anybody in danger, we'll stop them at that area because we're really, you know, every week we map the car stops. Are they where the crimes are occurring? But in the last 10 months, 18% of our car stops ended up with citations. Now, that doesn't mean we couldn't have written the other 82% of citations. We could have, but we elected not to because they're trying to use intelligent discretion and not inadvertently impose a poor people's tax because poverty and street crime are highly concentrated in the same places. And that's something that we're committed to doing something about because we're convinced that the neighborhoods which are characterized by high rates of poverty and unemployment cannot make a comeback as long as they are seen accurately as dangerous places to live and work. And so traffic enforcement does as a tool to achieve that. But I do want to emphasize that we are very much, you know, 80% of the time oriented towards not issuing the citation if we can avoid it, because we understand that can have an adverse impact on people without means.
There was a recent report that showed non-whites constitute about 82% of the people who received failure to pay forfeiture suspensions. So there are people who say that, you know, they look at that statistic and say, well, this means that African Americans and other minorities are being targeted more aggressively. Is that number striking to you, that the number of African Americans and other minority group members are so heavily represented in this failure to pay forfeiture suspension?
Well, here's what's disproportionate to me, all right? With about, what, 40% of Milwaukee's population, 42% of Milwaukee's population, African Americans represent 80% of our homicide victims. They represent 60% of our robbery victims. They represent 80% of our aggravated assault victims. They represent half of our burglary victims. They represent 56% of our car theft victims. So far, just this year, okay, just this year, 2,000 African Americans have been robbed. During that same period of time, 3,200 of them have been assaulted, okay? And in both cases, between 80 and 90% of the suspects were other African Americans. It's dangerous to live in these neighborhoods, and the people that are suffering the brunt of the grotesque disparity in victimization are the African American community. Now, I recognize people want to scrutinize the criminal justice system to make sure that it's fair and impartial, but I almost never hear this data referenced. It is though the arresting of African Americans takes place in some vacuum, disconnected to the reality of the fact that if I draw an ellipsis over our poorest neighborhoods and then find an ellipsis and draw it where our most 911 calls are, in other words, people asking for help, and then draw the ellipsis over where most of our crime victims are, and the same ellipsis is where most of our abandoned houses are, we've done this exercise. It's the same in neighborhoods and the same zip codes. And the same zip codes that produce most of the prisoners that have been referenced in this produce most of the city's crime victims. The five zip codes that produce the most incarcerated males produce two-thirds of the violent crime in this city, and the victims are other African Americans. Now, we're at the front end of the system, and what do we recognize? We, the police, are the social agency of first resort for the poor. We intervene in all manner of events in the lives of the poor because we're all there is. The bigger picture here is the criminal justice process and who's in jail is the end result of a large number of interrelated social failures. And the people that are left dealing with the result of American society's disinvestment in education and disinvestment in housing and disinvestment in healthcare and disinvestment in mental health services, all that's left are the people and the police. We're it, and we're in it together. Certainly, you know, raising the specter of the disparate impact incarceration has on these communities is important, but let's expand the analysis of what it's related to, okay? If every year I know that 2,000 African Americans are going to get robbed and 92% of the described suspects are African American, am I not obligated to bring justice to the victim and attempt to apprehend the offender? That is our reality. And I think all too often what gets lost in this discussion is the larger disparity of all, which is the disparity of being a victim of crime, correlates with race and poverty in our city.
Now, you are obviously, as the police department, not an agency of sentencing, but what do you see as the role of mandatory minimums in this equation? Is it something that you think needs to be reconsidered?
Well, I think it has been reconsidered in Wisconsin. I believe a few years ago they developed a sentencing matrix, by and large, to compensate for problems with mandatory minimums about drug offenses. But I've also advocated, however, myself, I've advocated for a mandatory minimum for one crime and one crime only, and that's the illegal carrying of a firearm. Because what we're finding is that we have a number of homicide victims would be alive today if the person who shot them was serving a sentence or having already been arrested with a gun. You know, our problem is to change the mental calculation of our young offenders. Because right now for them, if they choose a life of crime, it's more dangerous to not have a gun than to have a gun. Because getting arrested with a gun in this state is a misdemeanor, no matter how many times you're arrested. And our offenders are carrying guns at significant levels. We are seizing 2,000 guns a year from the streets of this city. That is a proportion every bit as high as Chicago's, in fact, higher than Chicago's rate of gun seizures. Now, that's significant because those young men are representing threats to themselves, to others, and they're terrorizing their communities. And we're trying to do something about it, and there are few tools at our disposal. So I would argue that mandatory sentences for drug possession are misguided, and I think it's a direction most of the country is heading away from, although there are still legacy costs from prior offenders serving time. But there are specific types of crimes. I think it is very useful. I mean, any mandatory sentence should have in it escape clauses for certain kinds of unusual circumstances. But we've got to change the decision making because the young men out there are armed with high quality, high capacity firearms, and they're using it. Every year in this city, there's a slow motion mass murder of young men by other young men in these neighborhoods. And that needs to be addressed on its own merits, because the choices after that event takes place is somebody's dead and somebody else is going to prison, affecting the same statistics that this series has already covered.
Well, let me ask a logistical question. I mean, I would imagine that a fair number of weapons charges come about as a result of these weapons being carried in cars that are stopped for traffic violations and, mm-hmm. and probably drug charges as well. What are the rules in terms of whether an officer is permitted to do a more intensive search of a car following a traffic stop?
Searches are dependent upon whether or not people have reasonable suspicion or have permission. Now, historically, very often, people would consent to a search of their vehicle. All right. And consent searches generated a fair amount of drug arrests over time. This past year, we reexamined our policy. Our goal in the car stops is not to seize more small amounts of drugs. It's never been our goal. Goal is to affect the amount of violent crime in public spaces in Milwaukee by generating high visibility police activity where these events are occurring. And so when we saw this was happening here, we refigured the policy, and the policy now says that you're not to ask consent for the search of a car unless you can articulate what your reasonable suspicion was. Now, legally, a consent search doesn't require reasonable suspicion. You can just, out of curiosity, search somebody's car. We're not encouraging that because we're trying to make sure that we are focused on the right offenders. I mean, in any given year, less than 10% of our offenders generate over half of our crime. As a matter of fact, in the first 6 months of last year, we had, I believe, something on the order of 80 juveniles who'd been arrested for four felonies in 6 months. Okay? We have serious high-rate offenders out there that start young. That's what we want to focus on. We don't want to trip over somebody that otherwise doesn't have a serious record, but because they gave us consent, we end up with a drug arrest. We're addressing that, and we're learning as we're going.
You talked about the increased rate of traffic stops that you've made, the ramping up of enforcement. Is, you know, the perception exists, I think, out there that officers are required to do a certain number of stops. Are there, I mean, do you tell your officers when they're going out that they should be making so many traffic stops?
No, there's no quota, but we do expect activity, okay? And we see that when, I mean, we have done this study with people that are qualified to do research. Our rate of car stops directly correlates with our rate of stolen cars. When the car stops go down, the stolen cars go up. When the rate of car stops go up, the stolen cars go down. Right now, our stolen cars in Milwaukee are about 50% less than they were before I got here. And that's directly attributable to our assertive behavior in the high crime neighborhoods. And keep in mind, this isn't just somebody's car is stolen. If you are an underemployed individual and you've got a car and that car gets stolen, there's a good chance you're going to lose your job because you can't get to it. All right? Public transportation doesn't get a lot of the places people need to do to get to work. And if they've got to take time off and get a car and get it registered, they're not going to be insured for stolen. They're going to have insurance for liability. That's all they're going to have. You're going to put a major crimp in their economic lifeline and maybe cost them their job. So, you know, reducing stolen cars isn't just an exercise in property crime. This is a direct impact on employment and economic viability, again, where the most stolen cars are, which is, once again, the disparity that afflicts poor people of color in this city.
When you go back and look at and assess the effectiveness of these programs, do you look at racial demographics of traffic stops as one of the things?
We analyze the racial demographics of traffic stops. We're the only city in the entire state that does this. You'll recall a law was passed some years ago which would require this data collection. But then when the new administration came into office, they had that law repealed. We voluntarily committed and made the announcement we would produce the data. And our reason to do that is we need to be able to explain to this community that we know what the demographic impact is of our enforcement strategies and that it is explainable. So when we look at our disparities, so to speak, we want to see if they match up with the other disparities. So when we analyze our car stops, we do it district by district by district. And we expect to see a lot more white people stopped in the south side of town in District 6 than we do in Districts, you know, 3, 5, and 7. And we expect to see more African Americans stopped in those districts than we see stopped in District 6. So far, our analysis as proxy measures, we look at the number of crime victims in that district, what their demographics are, the demographics of offenders, the demographics of car stops. And if the demographics of our car stops roughly line up with the demographics of the offenders and the victims, we feel that it's not really a racial disparity then. And so far, every year that we've done this, they haven't lined up perfectly, but they've certainly been within a margin of error to indicate to us that we're in the right places and we're not using inappropriate discretion.
Let's turn to the year that just finished. What do you think was the strongest storyline for the MPD over the past 12 months?
Well, I think we are taking major steps in trying to strengthen our most vulnerable communities by working with a variety of community groups to develop neighborhood-based leadership initiatives. With a BURN Innovation Grant that we received from the Justice Department, we're working very hard in the Washington Park area to not just to create safe public spaces, but to create the ability among the people that live there to advocate for themselves and to form social bonds so they can create the level of social capital necessary for informal social control. With a Building Neighborhood Capacity Grant from the White House, we're working in the Amani neighborhood and the Metcalf Park neighborhood to do something very similar, which is to build in those – I mean, they're some of the poorest, most crime-ridden neighborhoods in the city. We're trying to build the ability of the people that are remaining there who are committed to conventional lives to work together to get the services they need from the city and to resist crime. And we're focusing – you know, we were able to get money from the state for targeted demolitions. We're hoping to target those demolitions again in our highest crime neighborhoods to take out some of those buildings that are having the most negative impact where people live. I think that's very encouraging. On the downside, very frustrating for us. At the end of the first 6 months of this year, this city was on pace to have a record low number of homicides. It would have been the lowest number of homicides probably in 30 years. Then we had 20 homicides in 1 month, August, and 14 more in September. In 2 months, we had as many homicides as we had in the first 6 months of this year. And we're going to come in up in homicides. And that's very frustrating to us. We've been tracing the guns. We've been working hard on the social networks of the offenders. We're working very hard to focus on the high-rate offenders, focusing our enforcement efforts where these crimes have occurred in their greatest number. But it's been extremely frustrating for us as we're seeing a great deal of impulsive, immature violence out there. That's very hard to interdict because it's episodic and not necessarily related to something that was predictable.
Well, Chief Flynn, best wishes at 2014.
Thank you very much, and thanks for giving me an opportunity to address this important issue.
Edward Flynn is Milwaukee's chief of police. There's more of our conversation at WUWM.com/Lake Effect. You'll also find the other segments from our Project Milwaukee series there as well. Another break now, and then the charge of the DNR and how it's shifted under the direction of Secretary Kathy Stepp. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.